Buen día a todos.
Good morning, everybody. We're going to begin. Some of us are going to speak in Spanish, but there will be interpretation, English, Spanish, Spanish, English. So could you please check? As far as I understand, the Arabic booth has the Spanish interpreters, so you must find English will be in the English channel, Spanish will be in the Arabic channel, and I believe Spanish will be in channel 4.
To this event, I thank you all for coming. There is interpretation to Spanish also, so please do check with your headphones. And the interpretation is in the Arabic cabin, so please do check that you have interpretation now. You have? Okay. Well, thank you. Muchas gracias por haber venido.
First of all, thank you very much. On behalf of the Mission of Argentina to the United Nations, I'd like to thank you for being here. I would also like to give you a warm welcome to this event on this roundtable on 30 years of democracy in Latin America, institutions, rights, and well-beings. I would like to welcome all ambassadors that are here, and of course, I'd like to thank our panel members today and for our co-sponsor, the Swedish Mission to the United Nations, along with the Mission of Argentina. As you all know, this event is co-sponsored by the Mission of Sweden and the Argentine Mission, the New School of Social Research, specifically the Observatory on Latin America, and CLACSO, which is the Latin American Center for Social Sciences. We would also like to give a warm welcome to Ms. Jessica Payeta, the regional director of the UNDP for Latin America and the Caribbean. You've been recently assigned, and we'd like to congratulate you. We have three parts to this event. The first segment is on inauguration in the hands of Ambassador Marita Perceval, who is the permanent representative of Argentina, and of Ambassador Martin Grinchitz, the permanent representative of Sweden. So let me give the floor to Ambassador Perceval and later on to the Ambassador of Sweden. Thank you very much.
Yes, a todos, a todas.
Good morning, all. Ladies and gentlemen, Ambassador Grinchitz, I'd like to thank you for co-sponsoring this morning. This is possible because of all of you being here today. This event has been inspired by the activities of CLACSO and their executive secretary, Pablo Gentile. I'd like to thank you. And also because of the support that has been given to generate spaces to think and forecast, analyze, and build positive agendas that our region is facing as our pending work or as challenges. The New School is here and it provides a space to reflect and of knowledge. I'd like to thank its president, David Manzant. I'd like to thank Michael Cohen, the director of the Latin American Observatory, and Minister Extreme was already thanking Jessica Fayeta, the director of the Regional Office for Latin America and the Caribbean of the United Nations Development Program. I'd like to thank you all very much. Not only is she very busy because she's just starting this new position, but the expectation that our countries have are also weighing on her. We wanted all kinds of interviews and breakfasts, so we will discuss the the NDGs and the post 2015 agenda. In any case, I'd like to also welcome all the young ladies and gentlemen who are here. I've read all the work, and it's an honor, Laura, when you say that the future challenge, in order to continue to go forward in widening the agenda focused on democracy, it must be from the view of human rights. We agree with you. When Edwin says that democracy is a process of difficult construction and that we must always shape the judicial and standard and framework for the states, we feel we must continue working on the building of democracies, real democracies, intense democracies with full participation of society. When Jesus says that thoughts on democracy in Latin America and the Caribbean always overvalued Western perspectives such as institutional focuses, leaving aside problems referring to reoccurring crisis of the state and structural obstacles to consolidate democracy in our region, we must agree because it is, in fact, this moment when we are trying to consolidate what we've achieved, we must stay where we are or we would go backwards. When William Sesson shows us a different dimension, how to go beyond formal democracy so that we can have a state, the rule of law with rights, and a democratic society, he points out that universal voting and participation by the people cannot be divided and separated from social inclusion. That is real representation, governability based on trust and democratic participation. When Laura says, well, then, of course, what William says is great, but in order to do that, we must add sectors and people, actors who have been invisible in the decision making. We have to promote social mobility through decent work, provide opportunities to access education in equal conditions, to establish accounting mechanisms and transparency for the state. This would be the way to improve the life of people that would lead us to well-being and a decent life. So William's challenge and Laura's scenarios tell us that, yes, this is all good, but in order to do that, we need to invest in policies of knowledge, Latin America and the Caribbean, which is so passionate to create, must bring the same passion to build on knowledge, share information, promote this disseminate the information and apply all this knowledge, not only to fill the needs that come from unresolved social issues, but also to grow and include, to design the future in the medium and in the long term. Pablo, not Pablo Gentil, but Pablo, the student who has a dialogue with us, says, well, look, why don't we talk about the quality of democracy? He quotes some authors, and he picks up the features of bad democracies. For instance, how can we live in democracy if we have democratic institutions, but poverty increases, social inequality waits around the corner, and insecurity frightens you, uncertainty paralyzes? Let us think. And we have the representative of Brazil here, so let's remember in our own language the social forum of Porto Alegre. Pablo invites us to think about possible democracies. possible democracies, are the necessary democracies in which civil societies have experiences to defend human rights, natural resources, responsible use of the land, equal distribution of territory, taking the impulse that society provides us to structure access and the exercise of human right to be equally distributed. So let us not reiterate the search for empty formalities. Let us see what our own societies have been generating, and let's compare ourselves to other geographies, how social movements in Latin America and the Caribbean have established and demanded new types of relationships with their governments. What have they achieved? They've been able to translate this into an agenda of democratic building a democracy. Rodolfo says to us, but of course, this new agenda of construction of democracy has one central point, which is education. Education with education policies. It emphasizes the concept of universality, the conceiving education as a right and the responsibility of the state to guarantee quality education for everyone. That, in fact, is the great roadway of inclusion. But then Sophia says, oh, come on, with traditional political parties, with political corporations that only want to look at their own interests? But what if we invite ourselves to do what we have been doing, which is to build challenges from the bottom up, to repoliticize social issues, so that would be what our governments would express? Then, William says, we agree. However, rather than excluding, because we've done so much exclusion in Latin America and the Caribbean, why don't we include? Let's include politicians, NGOs, let's include everyone in public debate in order to democratize the word. Let's democratize the word so ideas can flow. In order to make the word democratic, to democratize democracy. So thank you for allowing me to study you, for allowing us to find things in common, and for being able to frame what we in Argentina have experienced. And I'm going to tell you some historians' social experience that the judge of the court, Raúl, of the judge of the Supreme Court of Justice in Argentina, Raúl Zaffaroni, said. He said, we were recovering democracy in 1983 in terms of civil rights by having a law of marriage and indissoluble marriage. But 30 years later today, society demanded to have the law of gay marriage. And these are some of the changes that we believe need to be strengthened. Thank you so much.
Gracias, Embajador Perceval. Ambassador Green.
So much, Ambassador Perceval.
Thank you, and many thanks to you, Marita, for your stimulating questions and all the challenges you threw up on the table. And thank you very much for giving Sweden the honor to co-host this event. I hope the enthusiasm that you triggered here in the room will not be dampened by the words I'm going to contribute, because I'm going into a little bit of the background as to why CEDA, actually our aid agency, actually embarked on support on the CLACSO program, and also to say a few words more generally on our engagement in Latin America. We all know that in the last last few decades, Latin America has consolidated democracy and made tremendous progress. But if we look back 30 years to the mid-70s, the contrast is indeed striking. At that time, a considerable part of the continent was ruled by military dictators, and there was brutal oppression, disappearances, tortures, and murders. Many of those who dissented, they had to leave home, family, and country. And Latin American political refugees were scattered all over the globe. Sweden was no exception. Many found protection and asylum and a new home in Sweden, where the Latin American the Latin Americans formed a very successful and very engaged community. You may also recall that, some of you may recall at least, that one of our ambassadors at the time in Santiago, Ambassador Edelstam, single-handedly showed a great deal of courage and unconventional diplomacy, to say the least, by giving refuge and asylum on the spot to no less than 1,300 Chileans and other Latin Americans at that time being threatened very severely by the troops of Pinochet. Sweden's engagement for democracy in Latin America gave rise to a development cooperation program with the aim of supporting the democratic change that started, and also to give support to opposition inside and outside the countries under oppression. As part of that, in 1977, we started supporting a range of independent social and economic research institutions in Latin America, among them CLACSO. These alternative research centers produced highly relevant studies in a context where universities had little or no space at all for social science research due to the repression. I want to highlight four important features and results of this program. First, the support was in the form of core institution funding, allowing long-term institution building and considerably strengthened research capacity in the social sciences. Second, the supported institutions were able to act as platforms for critical social and economic research. Third, the political impact was significant. The research centers contributed to democratization and peace processes. An impressive number of researchers became important agents of change. Some later served as ministers or, in a few cases, even as presidents when their countries had regained democracy. And fourth, these research centers were well placed to provide education and training for civil society and government agencies in democratic transition. Our relationship with Latin America has, of course, developed very considerably following these democratic breakthroughs and the impressive economic and social advancement of the continent. We now enjoy extensive and flourishing relations with Latin American countries. There are political and strategic partnerships with great substance. There are very important investments and a flourishing two-way trade. And we also cooperate on energy, climate change issues, on culture, education, innovation, and also still on governance and human rights issues. Conversely, our development assistance and development cooperation has changed substantially over the last decade as a consequence of the overall positive political, economic, and social developments in partner countries. Bilateral programs are now few, but Sweden remains a very large core contributor to UN funds and programs and is also the third largest humanitarian donor in the world, applied, for instance, in Haiti, to mention a recent example. In addition, we, of course, also promote the modern agenda with Latin America by way of the European Union. And here, the realization of the vision of free trade between the two continents is now center stage. And we are also a proud and contributing partner to the Organization of American States. So all in all, we're pleased to have a rich, modern, and growing relationship with Latin America. And we're, of course, also very pleased to be associated with the history and development of social science research in Latin America. And I'm very much looking forward to today's presentations of Glaxo Fellows, as well as the panel considerations and the general discussion in this room. Thank you very much, Marita, once again, for inviting us. Thank you.
Muchas gracias, embajador.
Embajador Greenidge, thank you very much for your words and for your support to this program. Now, the Executive Secretary of Glaxo has the floor, Mr. Pablo Gentili, PhD in education at the National University and Master in Education of the Latin America University of Social Sciences, and he is also a professor of the State University of Rio de Janeiro. Mr. President, you have the floor. Good morning to all of you. It is a great honor for me to be here at a personal, at an institutional level. I would like to especially thank my friend for many years, an example of so many women in Argentina who have struggled, who have been the protagonists of this process of consolidation of democracy as of the 80s. Ambassador Marita Perceval, I thank you all from the Argentinian delegation for your help. I thank Ambassador Greenidge and the Swedish delegation as well. I would also like to thank the Swedish government because the institution I work in, Glaxo, exists in a large measure and has existed since 1967, created by UNESCO, thanks to the generosity of the Swedish government through SIDA. Many of the things you know about Glaxo, many of the things that made Glaxo one of the main academic networks in the world with more than 15,000 researchers on social sciences, with 400 associated institutions in 26 countries in Latin America, the Caribbean, Europe, the United States, and Canada, an institution with almost 50 working groups in diverse countries, in diverse fields of social sciences, with masters, with PhDs, with a huge digital library with more than a million downloads a month. All this exists in large measure because our state universities in America in Latin America work, and because we have been recipients of the generosity of the Swedish government and SIDA. It is an honor to share the panel with a high ambassador of the Swedish government, and I truly appreciate it. I would like also to thank you all the students present here who developed their work. We are going to be able to listen to the presentations, to three of these presentations. These research works are enormously rich and important in content. I don't know whether I will be as short as Marita wanted. Nonetheless, I'll do my best. We've been working with a new school and with the Observatorio of America Latina and its president, Ivan Balsan. Thank you, Margarita Balsan, and Mr. Cohen. Thank you all for generosity, for having welcomed us here in New York. We are working together in different initiatives. And as I was saying, we discussed several things that I would like to mention very briefly here. First of all, when we talk about 30 years of democracy in Latin America, we need to recognize the heterogeneous nature of our continent. And we need to talk about democracies, as Michael Cohen mentions, than a democracy in Latin America, because there are all sorts of democracies in our continent. Beyond these national specificities, we need to highlight that 30 years of democracy show us positive results in the region. I come from Italian origins. My grandfather was a cook. He was Italian, and he would always ask me questions. When I mentioned something, he would ask me, in relationship to what do you say that? So we are always thinking of relations between things. And these 30 years of democracy are a good and a positive result, because we compare these 30 years of democracy to 21 years, in Brazil at least, of repression, of the imposition of accumulation models that produced wealth in a very unequal way. These democracies have been the result, are the results of social movements. We need to highlight that today we have a model of representative democracy with strong institutions, with differences, of course, but democracy today in Latin America is very strong, is highly consolidated, and democracy has become a value which is defended, strongly defended by Latin Americans. We can always define and discuss about the different definitions and models of democracy for Latin America, but something we do not negotiate is about the importance of democracy, the importance of democracy, the importance of multiplying democracy, of duplicating it, of exporting it in all countries of Latin America is a must, and we do not negotiate that. There are social movements, there are popular and human rights movements. There are so many social institutions which make of our societies a highly democratic societies. As Eric Hirschberg says, there has been a change of elites in our governments. That is highly important. In Latin America, we have governments linked to parties, to indigenous movements, something which was inconceivable 30 years ago. This has led to a change of groups of power, and that is very healthy for democracy. It is true, nonetheless, that the matrix of accumulation of Latin America has not changed so much. Nonetheless, we need to say that we have economic stability in Latin America. In 2008, the world lived a huge economic crisis, and Latin America could handle it quite healthily. And in these past 30 years, we've seen governments who wanted to change, who wanted reform, who wanted to affirm the rights which had been denied in the past, and which had criticized conservative governments from the past. So politics became a promoting agent for social justice, for change, for equality. And that's excellent news for democracy in our continent. When we analyze the consequences and when we study these past 30 years of democracy, we need to think about the future as well, the next 30 years. And I will paraphrase Klaus Hofer and Schmidt. We can say that the more we consolidate democracy, the more complex its future seems to be. We need to develop that from a social point of view. We cannot think about the past from a platform of social sciences. We need to think about the future. We need to imagine the future we want in the following, in the next 30 years. And it is in this sense that the future of democracy, we have discussed this in Ole New School and in Claxo, the future of democracy is tightly linked to equality and social justice, to the conquest of civil rights, not only respected by the law, which is necessary, but that should be reflected in the citizens' everyday lives, especially the most vulnerable ones. Democracy and social justice are tightly linked in Latin America's future. As Ambassador Percival said, we can say without fear that the balance is very positive. Nonetheless, there are certain risks when we think about the future. I am going to be very, very brief, but I would like to say that there has been a huge reduction of poverty in our continent. That is superlative news, and this is the result of our policies and of the result of social struggle for so many years. The social movements have been a huge contributor for this change. There are, nonetheless, processes of accumulation of wealth, which are vicious for our continent. We are the most unequal region of the world, and this is a huge problem for democracy. Production of poverty, someone said. Production of poverty. And this is also repeated in Piketty's book, Capital. Production of wealth is linked to the production of poverty, of course. And this is the paradox of Latin America. Governments push the most vulnerable ones out of poverty. Governments, states, thanks to their public policies, generate a process of poverty eradication, improving their social and living conditions. Nonetheless, the market pushes them back. So the state tries to eradicate poverty, but the market perpetuates poverty. And this is a huge risk for our democracies. We need to change these structures of economic and wealth concentration. On the other hand, this inequality has become more complex and more resilient to change, and we need to reflect upon this. We can see that the policies of redistribution have good results, but it is not enough. It is not enough to redefine or modify the reproductive structure of inequality in Latin America. In order to make the labor market more dynamic, we need to change education. Many, many people said that. We had this change in education in Latin America. There has been a huge expansion and enlargement of education. Nonetheless, the market is exactly the same, and the labor market has not changed at all. There's discrimination, there's racism, there's gender discrimination, and these practices are a reality of nowadays, despite the fact that the governments make efforts. Today, for example, many black women can have access to schools of medicine, which had been denied for many years for them. Many women had been denied from education for so many years. Today, they are part of these schools of medicine, and they have the best grades and the best degrees. And when this woman, when this black woman student has her degrees, goes to the labor market, she can earn 40% less than a white male medicine. The University of Chile, for example, published a very interesting and very courageous report showing that within university, gender discrimination is rampant, starting by vice rectors. There's one vice rector, one vice male vice rector, and two female vice rectors who earn 25% less than the male vice rector. So we need to think about these gender, ethnic, and racial discriminations in our continent. Finally, violence. We've always said that we needed to improve the living conditions of the most vulnerable and the most poor ones, and violence will disappear. This has not been the case for these past 30 years. The living conditions have improved, and violence is still rampant. So we need to think about this, because violence is a reality for the most vulnerable ones. We're not talking about a general sense of violence. We're talking about everyday violence in the most vulnerable sectors, the most harsh part of violence is suffered by the most vulnerable sectors. Violence of the police, family violence, and gang violence. These three types of violence are terrible in Latin America. In Brazil, there has been a huge success of living conditions for the most vulnerable sectors, and yet every 30 minutes a black person dies because of violence. One of the biggest shames we have in our continent is that homicide is the highest cause of violence. We need to change our policies in order to do away with this reality we live and we suffer. There's a huge challenge for us in this sense. To analyze the past to understand the present is a good way, a humble but a good way to change the future. Good diagnoses do not guarantee good policies. Nonetheless, bad diagnoses always generate bad policies. It is in this sense that I appreciate being here celebrating 30 years of democracy at the UN. And this meeting enables us to understand that we still have so many challenges when we see towards the future. We need to consolidate our democratic conquests. We need to enlarge the opportunities reaching the most vulnerable, guaranteeing their rights. Our future depends on a democracy that can transform itself, that can reflect upon itself, and that can consolidate itself for all. We are positive in Claxo that we can achieve this. Thank you very much.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much, Dr. Gentili. I'd like to give the floor to Mr. David Van Sant, president of the New School. Mr. Van Sant is the 8th president of the New School. He is a sociologist, an attorney specializing in education, and his career is over 30 years long. Before being at the New School, he was the dean of the Law School of Northwest University since 1995 until 2010. So, Dr. Van Sant, my
participate in this panel. I am very glad that the New School is actively collaborating with Claxo and the UN missions of Argentina and Sweden in this event. And I'm particularly honored to be on the same panel with Ambassadors Grunditz and Percival and also Ms. Vieta. It is wonderful to be here. Finally, I met Pablo Gentile in Buenos Aires last August, when I had an opportunity to visit CLACSO headquarters and to see their impressive operations. I participated in the first discussions of the possibility of this event, and am pleased to see that the New School, together with CLACSO, has organized this series of events this week on the 30 years of democracy in Latin America. The subject of democracy is one which has always been at the core of the New School's academic agenda. One of its founders was Charles Beer, a prominent economic historian who focused on the economics behind the U.S. Constitution and the political evolution of the young democracy in the United States. And other New School faculty included scholars such as Thorsten Vleben and Hannah Arendt, both of whom wrote extensively about the theories of how modern politics and cultures actually operated. As a university, we have been known for our critical perspective on social and political life, not only in the U.S., but also overseas. In fact, the New School has a long and deep history of involvement with these issues at the international level. In the years before World War II, in 1933, we established a university in exile, which brought scholars who were European political refugees. We also were heavily involved in the movements for political rights in Eastern Europe in the 1980s. We are now the university in the United States with the highest proportion of undergraduate students from outside the U.S., reflecting, of course, in part, the attraction of New York, but also our wide range of academic offerings, from the social sciences to policy analysis to design. At the New School, we strongly believe that theory and practice must go together. Today, we have adopted a particular role in regard to Latin America. We established an observatory on Latin America in 2006 with the objectives of learning more about the changes in the region, mobilizing resources and ideas to contribute to progressive change, and to build institutional partnerships, such as our work with CLACSO. We have created a space for Latin Americans to come to New York to speak to the New York audiences without the mediation of the press. We have been honored by the visits of many Latin American presidents and senior officials, as well as hundreds of academics who come to present and debate their work. We also established the President Nestor Kirchner a fellowship program together with the Universidad Nacional de Saint Martin of Buenos Aires to honor the late president who gave his last foreign speech before his death at the New School. This fellowship brings to New York young leaders with both an academic project and strong commitment to public service. It has been our honor to have the strong support of Ambassador Percival in this fellowship program, where she has been a juror and speaker at the New School. Now, given this history, I would like to raise several substantive questions, which I believe are worth considering in these discussions. My first question for us to think about is whether democracy actually directly leads to material progress. This question's had a long and controversial academic history across countries, with some scholars arguing quite forcefully that there is no proven statistical relationship between democracy and material improvements in areas such as education, health, environmental management, or reduction in poverty and income disparities. The experience of China challenges easy assertions of this relationship. And yet, we do believe that there must be a relationship between what might be called good government and material progress. The dramatic progress of South Korea over the last 50 years shows that countries can invest in their people and have demonstrated results. Korea itself is an interesting example because a portion of its economic growth occurred during non-democratic periods, and a later period has occurred with democratic governance. Could it be that democratic governance only gets a nation so far down the path of material progress, and to go further, democracy is needed? So we need to be careful about our conclusions and find ways to demonstrate, if not prove, how governance has important consequences in material life. This is particularly noteworthy in Latin America, as a wave of new governments, which took office in the last decade, is being asked to demonstrate their accomplishments. A second question concerns our definitions of democracy itself. Many member countries of the United Nations claim to be democratic, while others argue that such claims are not correct. We must be more careful in defining democracy in the 21st century. Democracy is not only the occurrence of periodic free elections with peaceful transfers of power. But it's also the existence of the rule of law, including an effective and impartial application of the law through a functioning judicial system, and, very importantly, an even-handed enforcement of judicial decisions. In addition, democracy may require the respect for human rights of individuals and political minorities. Another important question for the definition of democracy is whether countries with high levels of inequality can be democracies for purposes of analyzing the impact of democracy on material growth. They may believe in liberty and freedom of expression, but surely we believe that inequality reduces equal opportunity. We know that inequality also subverts efforts to promote economic growth and in certain circumstances can undermine the commitment to democracy itself. In other cases, great inequality allows an oligarchic class to have undue influence in democratic processes so as to undermine the existence of democracy. These questions are not resolved even here at the UN headquarters. Yet our representatives at the UN must work with assumptions about these issues as they vote on issue after issue, whether in the Security Council or the General Assembly. A third question is which of these questions are actually researchable? Which issues are amenable to evidence-based declarations of fact and reality? Coming from a university, I am committed to the idea that we can advance our understanding of these issues, even if we cannot resolve them finally, through open research studies and the effective use of data. Saying that, however, does not mean that such studies are easy or simple. As with all research, we must move incrementally. Despite these difficulties, I would suggest that it is our role to keep posing these questions and attempting to answer them, just as Claxo scholars have done in their papers, to help improve the operational meaning of these ideas in daily public practice. Finally, I would like to conclude by emphasizing that working on these issues is both an exciting intellectual challenge and a passionate, compelling life work, whether as a researcher, an activist, or as a staff member at the United Nations. More than 75 of our New School graduates are working here at the UN headquarters, and many current students are working in internships and short assignments here. We hope that they are continuing to ask provocative questions and working to help construct sustainable, just solutions. Thank you.
Gracias, Señor Van Zandt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Van Zandt. Let me give the floor to the last panel member of this segment, which is Ms. Jessica Fayeta, the director of the Regional Office for Latin America and the Caribbean of the UNDP. Mrs. Jessica Fayeta has a Master in Business Administrations and in International Relations, both from the Columbia University. She's also a work fellow of the University of Yale. She was named, as we said at the beginning, the regional director of UNDP for Latin America and the Caribbean on May 7th, 2014. Jessica, you have the floor. Well, thank you so much, Mateo. I'd like to begin by expressing my thanks to my friend and Ambassador Percival for inviting me to this event. I can't think of a better way, a more symbolic way of beginning my work as a regional director of Latin America and the Caribbean than to discuss Latin America and democracy, particularly while sharing this panel with people that are committed to democracy and human rights, such as the ambassador, the government of Sweden, represented by the ambassador, and such important academics such as Pablo Gentile from Claxo and David Van Zandt from the New School. Of course, also to share this with colleagues and friends, ambassadors and representatives of the Latin American and Caribbean region. I would like to congratulate all the scholarship students who, with their work, have contributed and will enrich this debate. The UNDP's mandate is to promote sustainable human development and democratic governance. UNDP has promoted this concept beyond democracy, electoral democracy, which has been established in Latin America and the Caribbean. Its idea of democracy is wider. It is about the crucial role that citizens play and in the full exercise of human rights. It means that civil, political, and social society must participate. Our regional report on democracy 2004 is called Citizen Democracy. Citizens, in this case, is more than just the voting person. The interaction between citizens and political representatives must cause rights to be widened, renewed, and be put today according to current concepts. It is important to listen to the claims and demands of an empowered citizenship and think of how citizens evaluate the functioning of their institutions. As a Latin American myself, when I look at the challenges and progress in our democracy during the last decades, I think it's important to underline the good achievements that we've made. Some have already been mentioned. I'd like to also look at the view of what we still need to do. Our countries today have regular elections, and changes in government happened naturally. There is more and more citizen participation. States have made important progress. They have modernized their constitutions in order to provide more rights. We have more access to civil, political, social, and cultural rights. We've increased the human development levels and social inclusion. In a recent UNDP study on the region, on the state of democracy in 2011, we see that our countries show important progress in terms of social citizenship. Latin America improved their level of social spending per citizen and equal distribution at a time in which most countries in the world were experiencing the opposite. One of the most important facts, and it's been mentioned here as well, is that the last 10 years have seen a decrease in poverty, and approximately 90 million Latin Americans became part of the middle class, representing one-third of its population. To recognize these important achievements doesn't mean that we forget that we have much to do, challenges in terms of poverty and inequality. Even if it's decreased in the last few years, we still suffer the greatest levels in the world of income inequality. There is also inequalities in gender, age, ethnicity, and the qualities of democratic institutions and the results of public policies in things like health, education, housing, and safety. Pablo Gentile mentioned some of these things and talked about inequality. There is support to democracy in the region, but empowered citizens with the claim, the things that are needed to move forward in democratic governance, to widen the representation by citizens, particularly of women, include young people, indigenous people, and Afro-descendants. We need to strengthen public institutions in order to have more transparency, accountability, and better results of public policies, to promote spaces for dialogue and wide national consensus, to promote better public policy for sustainable human development. Many of our countries have seen that our citizens demonstrate on the streets and on the internet what they required. We see political activism by young people and middle class, and in some countries also by indigenous people. These mechanisms are a product of the citizen empowerment that has been built during the last decades. These complement other institutional forms of participation which search to amend for the low trust in public institutions. The region has seen a new priority in promoting an agenda of participation and inclusion, focusing on the empowerment of women, children, Afro-descendants, and indigenous people. In terms of gender, let me say that while we've seen some progress, the participation of women in decision-making processes is still quite limited, and it's far from being equal. Currently, there are 5 heads of state and governments in the region. However, 30% of participation in parliament has only been reached in 8 countries in the region, which the average is really only 22%. These are 2012 data. 23% of ministers are women, only 11% of women that are heads of local governments. Another study by the UNDP has seen that gender equality is a fundamental indicator of a democracy, degree of a political system, and it's an indicator of inequalities that persist in our societies. It is clear that we need to promote strongly an agenda of equality to improve the quality of our democracies. One of the main challenges that we face today in the region is to increase and diversify representation so that it would better reflect the heterogeneity of our societies. To conclude, let me say that the efforts to develop and bring democracy have produced many, many achievements. Many have been mentioned already. Democracy has not been interrupted again in the countries of the region, and recognizing it as the best political management is something that all citizens believe today. But as we've said, there is still a lot of inequality in our societies, which has a big impact in the quality and functioning of our institutions. The UNDP, which is the organization I represent in Latin America, will continue pushing forward a democracy of citizenship, and we will continue to strengthen the starring role of women and men, citizens and agents of change, and the capacity of public institutions to promote democratic governance and sustainable human development in our region. Thank you.
Muchas gracias, Jessica.
Thank you very much, Jessica. Now, we have concluded the first segment of our event. Let me thank all the panelists for your presentations, and let me invite Mr. Michael Cohen, the director of the Latin America Observatory of the New School for Social Research, so that he will moderate a second segment along with 3 of the fellows from CLACSO. So may I? Really. Let's reorganize the panel.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to start second panel. We're very, I think the presentations in the second panel follow on very well from the earlier comments made in the first panel, which tended to consider the region as a whole with some broad assessment of both the accomplishments and the challenges for democracy. In this panel, we are going to have three presentations by three of the 12 CLACSO fellows who were chosen basically to give the audience and people here a sense of the diversity of concerns from different regions on different questions that we thought would be instructive. I think in this context, one of the things I'd like to refer to before turning the floor over to the fellows is to make the observation emphasizing what Pablo Gentili said earlier about the fact that in our meetings earlier this week, we've been talking about democracies, not democracy. We've been talking about plurality, about diversity, about differences, about conditions, both institutional, political, as well as social and economic, which are very greatly across the region. And one of the questions that comes out of this kind of discussion is whether we consider the countries and the democracies at this point as spaces of hope, or whether we consider them to be under challenge, both from the effects of the global economy or for other kinds of reasons, whether climate change or other things. Another way to say this, as my colleague Margarita Gutman says, are we talking about a horizon of hope or a horizon of menace? And I think it's important to realize that while the democracies have evolved in many interesting ways, as you will hear, I think we all have to come to some kind of assessment, whether we believe the glass is half full or half empty, what remains to be done, what are the desafios, what are the challenges that need to be done. And as Ambassador Perceval said quite eloquently, there's lots to be done. Our first speaker will be Sofia Donoso from Chile, who will talk about the politics of the student movement around education, which we thought was a particularly interesting example of the connection of politics and material progress. Our second speaker is Pablo Uc from Mexico, who has a broader view of Mexico and Central America going through a different kinds of processes than in South America, although there are certainly similarities. And finally, Ana Laura Giorgi from Uruguay, who talks about, who has focused on rights and how rights enter the political agenda. So we think these three young scholars have lots to offer, and so I'm going to turn it over to them. Each will speak for about 15 minutes. Sofia, it's all yours.
So I'm going to speak in Spanish. Yes. Okay. Bueno.
I'm Sofia Donoso. I'm doing a post-PhD at the Center of Studies for Social Conflict in Chile. I would like, first of all, to thank you all for giving me the possibility of sharing with you research and the opportunity of being here in New York with you and among you. As part of the CLACSO scholarships program, I've been studying the student movement in Chile and how it achieved the repoliticization of the Chilean educational system and the way of doing politics in Chile in the post-transition era as of the 1990s when we reestablished democracy. Many of the outstanding challenges have already been mentioned. I'm not going to repeat them. However, I would like to give you a brief context of how I started to be interested in the student movement, which is not a process specific to Chile, but to many countries in the region. And it is inherently linked to the past 30 years of Latin America, this transition period. On the one hand, we became a economic state country to a liberal economic country, economist country. We passed from authoritarian regimes to democratic regimes almost everywhere in Latin America. We can discuss and debate on the nature of these democracies. We cannot talk about a single democracy, but several democracies. There are many differences. And as an example of that, I have to tell you that being with other fellows and with classmates, you can be very critical to your own country, but we learned a lot from this diversity, from this plurality, and this meeting has enabled me to share my experiences and to learn from the others and to realize that our challenges are huge, but we have challenges in every country of the region. As a result of my research, I can say that the student movements change the social structure, and there are new stakeholders on stage. We have new political parties. We have seen a transformation in the traditional political parties, and there has been an explicit change for a call for change from society. There are new stakeholders, new institutions, and new social forces. And these social forces will be the leading movements of next 30 years towards more social rights and conquests. When it comes to my research, specifically speaking, the student movement in Chile, I'd say it's a rather interesting topic because the post-transitional era, if you want to explain it in one sentence, I'd say that this is a process that started from a profound depolitization to a profound repolitization. The student movement is a good way to understand how to repoliticize, how to articulate social action, how do you articulate a discourse and a narrative concerning the challenges of a society. And of course, this was not born overnight in 2011. I wanted to study the evolution of the student movement as of the 90s. What I was very interested in was to identify the organizations behind this gradual construction of student movements and the political learning of students. Without understanding this political learning and political appropriation of students, we would never understand, for example, the mistrust there is in the political sphere from society and the necessary social-political alliances so as to go forward with the social agenda in Chile. The student movement questioned the institutional legacy left by the military regime, which was not minor. We were left with the constitution, with legislation. It is very broad to go into details, but our institutional legacy from the military government has been enormous. And the student movement also questioned the concertation in Chile, the alliances made after the transition, this lack of will to change the basis, the structural basis of public policies, which generate segregation, inequality, dissatisfaction, and which in a way prevent us from going forward. This is worth analyzing. We need to understand the processes of repoliticization because they are tightly linked. They have to do with how you build a discourse that satisfies public opinion, that appeals to their everyday reality. We need to identify the political conditions of the transformation, the agenda for transformation. I like Narcy Bermero. She says,
in political life, but its salience in political discourses rises and recedes. Es decir, la desigualdad siempre estuvo, ¿cierto? Es histórica, no es
política. Inequality has always existed. How do we create the political conditions in order to change, to eradicate inequality? And the student movement is a privileged window to understand this process, a process so necessary in order to be up to the challenges of the future in our societies. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Sofía.
Hola, ¿qué tal? Buen día.
Thank you very much for your invitation. I'm very honored to be here among you, amongst colleagues, amongst friends. It is true that our experiences in Latin America are very heterogeneous, but the space created by OLA, by CLACSO, and the effort to, in a way, meet these differences show us that this, in spite of the lack of information from other countries, we can get together and we can break these barriers. Social sciences give us the possibility to think critically, to analyze our situations, to share expectations, to discuss regarding threats and menaces. These institutions need to share these points of view, and this is one of the places we can do it. Of course, we have limitations when we need to describe Latin America, because it is a very heterogeneous region. There are many differences concerning our way of living, our way of interpreting these past 30 years of democracy. This is our main question. How do we define an answer to this situation? Who defines the spaces for democracy? Who gives words to democracy? In the case of Central America, which is a very important example of the South-South experience, I would like to start quoting Abelardo Morales in order to describe my research. If the region enjoys a certain climate of peace, if fragile democracies have not died because of their defects, if markets have not been destroyed, It is not because of neoliberalism, which has been a permanent term in our region these past 30 years. It is because of heroism of 5 million Central American citizens who, in order to save their countries, they decided to leave. Abelardo makes it very clear. It is other stakeholders, it is other spaces which demand a definition of democracy and a definition of the development of democracy. Behind the questions of material or main changes of democracy, behind the idea of evolution, of progress, there are intermittences, there are spasms. And it is behind what we do not visualize that I placed myself in order to study the work of others, my colleagues who have helped me a lot understand the experiences of the region. It is necessary to see democracy as a geopolitical discourse. The peripheric and semi-peripheric of insertion of Latin America is the other reason of democracy in South America, beyond elections, beyond political parties. We can give the example of El Salvador, of Guatemala. Can we establish democracies in a context of war? The situation of capital accumulation demanded a contention of violence, and that was very important. And democracy has helped in this sense. The violent situation of the region became, and thanks to diplomacy of Latin America with its contradictions, with its spasms and convulsions, we arrived in the 90s where peace agreements were signed. For example, the experience of Nicaragua tells us that we need to recognize the profound differences in our region, a region which is always identified as one. We have our differences. Costa Rica shows that to us. For example, Laura explains that in her research. We need to reinterpret experiences from different parts of Latin America in these past 10 years. In spite of our differences, we can see that our region has become one in the progress of democracy, in projects of, for example, answering the foreign policy of the United States. It has become one in a project towards the future. It has become one saying that we do not negotiate when it comes to democracy. It has become one when we fight against drugs. We are one continent when we fight against human trafficking, when we fight against neoliberalism. We build a model of oriented and exports of labor. That happened before democracy. That was diaspora, and unfortunately, we suffer today the consequences of that. We are defining our democracies, and we need to include the migration policies of our states. For example, in Mexico, we have to think of migration as a state policy that, in a way, rejects its own citizens because of the violence suffered in the Mexican country. We need to think about the possibilities of equality and of the right to come back to our countries, or the right to travel without having these border limitations, the right of migrants to go back.
Of this third neoliberal wave made a change in structure of exports, and today we see this expressed not only in the dependency and fragility of the economies of the regions, which depend on remittances that come, as a matter of fact, from their fellow countrymen that live abroad, but also a different type of expressions which are essential to critically read the experience of democracy. This means that we need to recognize that in this context in which we look for indicators that allow us to verify whether there is a true quality democracy, we see that in the Northern Triangle of Central America, we have multiple reports as one of the regions that is the most dangerous in the world. Is it possible to have democracy in a world, in a context of violence and diaspora? Could it be thought as a substantial and authentic democracy? It is, however, important to recognize that, in fact, we cannot imprison the idea and the expectation of possible democracies in this framework of democracies that are assured the securitization of the social fabric that's been fragmented. And I would emphasize the awareness and the look through research, the opening of our views in order to find other kinds of democracies that are being built. And these are, in fact, civil societies, indigenous movements, social movements in the continent, which are also challenging these border limitations that were imposed by the states in order to think and express the daily experience in different scales and different forms, which generate, obviously, reactions of violence and, like, the experience of autonomy, which is an essential self-determination experience. If I quote René Savaletta, the singer, thinker, democracy means, of course, institutions, a capacity of representation, the ability to, the capacity to participate, but also self-determination and self-governance when structures don't allow inequality to be a part of a social policy. So unfortunately, in these cases, the last May 2nd, one of the teachers of the San Batista school has been assassinated in the region of Chiapas. Obviously, this isn't an isolated incident, but it shows us that there is a persistence of paramilitary structures and violence. But democracy is still built and imagined outside the structure of national states. It is imagined in the networks of thought and social scientists, and it's practiced daily as a latent possibility insofar as, in this way, the cruel diagnosis that brings us to this number of statistics and reports not only show us the important need to evaluate what does it mean and what's behind the word and the concept of democracy. This is part, we need to make this project concrete, and it's part of the dialogue that we're having. So thank you so much for your attention, and let us hope that our work together will be fruitful, and that the ears of institutions will be opened and willing to learn in the best sense of the word. And once again, let me thank you for the invitation to present.
Very terrific presentation. Ana Laura.
Buenos días.
Good morning. I am Ana Laura De Giorgi. First of all, let me thank you for being here, for listening, for receiving us. I'd like to thank the organizations that made this event possible. I'd like to especially thank Claxo, which pushed us to think about this challenge on thinking about democracy in Latin America. This is a challenge for us because we need to have some perspective for some of us. It's hard because we were born, we're almost 30. Well, we're over 30, just barely over 30. And this is the democracy we were born in, we grew up with, and we need to have some perspective in order to be able to reflect on it and analyze it. I was born in 1980 in Uruguay, which is the same year in which we had a vote for the constitutional reform that by the militaries, and we said no. That's when the process of democratic transition began. My research was on democracy and human rights from the perspective of the left. This wasn't just a whim, but because I did this because the human rights agenda in Uruguay was basically and specifically built by the left. The left began governing in 2005, but it is part of a much longer process, and we need to go back to the 80s, because it is then when we see the discourse on human rights, democracy, will re-signify democracy. And so the 80s will be a moment of particular openness, and it can illustrate and explain what the situation is today. My main goal was to re-signify democracy and the emergence of a human rights agenda. Human rights in the wider sense of the word, understanding this to be human rights referring to the violations of human rights by terrorism of the states and new human rights that are today part of the concept as of human rights. I try to go back to how the human rights agenda began and the new agenda for human rights. As I said, the 80s were key for this because of the way people participated. The 80s were a moment of break and opening, even within an authoritarian regime and in the context of political transition. There was the emergence of a new political generation that experienced several spaces that somehow the weakness of the political and party structures gave us the opportunity to have a new political generation emerge for dialogue, for participation, and to build shared spaces to have a new discourse on democracy, but of political democratic practices and a political generation, which was the generation of the 80s, which discussed how left organizations showed political practices that were democratic. So the democratization of democracy and the discourse of democracy wasn't just big words, but it was a constant monitoring so that these agendas would, in fact, be built democratically. We went through the first stage, the 80s, and later on, we had a lost decade. And in terms of human rights, this was not the 80s. It was rather the 90s, from 1990 until 2000, which is the lost decade for human rights because the agenda was completely put away. Those who had a human right agenda could not defend it, could not pressure enough, even though they were barely heard. It is as of 2000 when things begin to change. In Uruguay, things change when we have the Commission for Peace, which is similar to the Truth Commission that other countries had. But essentially, the agenda changed in 2005 during the first left government of Uruguay, Frente Amplio, and continues to change in 2010 during the second government by the Frente Amplio. So, as I was saying, during the 80s, this generation was very important, a generation which, during the 80s, it emerged in the 80s after living through dictatorship. They were 17 through to 25 years old during the 80s. They began to living democracy, human rights, new ways of doing politics, and became quite disillusioned in 1989 when Uruguay had a referendum to repeal the law of the law of amnesty. It's not called amnesty, but it's a law that disallows us to judge all the military junta. So this moment of effervescence of the 80s became diluted in 89, and there were other failures, or rather disenchantments, I guess, that accumulated. In terms of human rights, that happened with the left. Of course, what happened? This agenda began in exile, particularly in Uruguay. The institutions were very, very weak. They took a lot of lessons from Argentina. The human rights agenda, organizations, political practices that were developed were quite parallel to the Argentine process, which was a little bit more ahead of time. And so we took these examples and the lessons. Obviously, the commitment to human rights by the left was not the same in all the sectors of the left, because we had a few debates which will be reflected in the government once the left takes the government. The re-signifying of democracy implied a re-evaluation of formal rights and questioning by the left, and this questioning of militant practices, vigilance for militant practices and political practices to be democratic. Another important thing is that the hegemony of the dominance of the democratic discourse allowed the agenda of demands to be widened and to open up the agenda for the left. In the 80s, women began to ask for their rights. The homosexuals wanted the right to sexual freedom. And in that sense, the agenda of the left became bigger. The human rights discourse allowed us to redefine the agenda and include other rights. This, however, did not happen in the basic party of the left. I must say it happened in the social left. This innovative agenda during the 80s was a social agenda and not the party's agenda. The party's agenda, which in this case was called Frente Amplio, it took quite a few years to include this agenda, and it's still taking them time. And we can hear this in the parliament when you have voting for different rules, what the left's position is in terms of the new rights agenda. During the second government of the Frente Amplio, we see the new agenda. And today, we have things such as the quota law for parliament representation, voluntary interruption of pregnancy, the gender law that allows to adopt minors by same-sex couples, gay marriage, and the laws of the marijuana market. This is all new, and it happened during the second government of Frente Amplio. The new rights agenda also took the social and political place that the classic human rights agenda had previously occupied during the first government of Frente Amplio when Tabárez Vázquez was the president. That agenda was very new compared to traditional governments, but it was very difficult to manage and to govern. So somehow the left experienced some difficulties, and its militants, even though they were a majority in the parliament, had a lot of difficulty to manage the human rights agenda and to annul the law of prescription. In 2009, we had another popular basic consultation. It's not a plebiscite nor a referendum, but a new questioning of people about this law, of pardon law. Even in Uruguay today is current. In spite of the new laws, new interpretations, and the new law that repeals, et cetera, it's hard to explain. But nevertheless, this law is still in the books. We have a new rights agenda today that did not come from within the left party. These were not things that were part of the platform of Frente Amplio. This came from the social left, which could be considered a weakness, but as Margarita was telling me the other day, it is also a strength because the party left was able to capitalize on the debates that were happening in the left, in the social left, and to have the opportunity to connect these demands. And so the left fed off of the debates, and it was the left that finally translated this into laws. To conclude, the post-dictatorship left re-signified democracy and deposited all its expectations in competitive democracy. The 1989 has a clear example. The left believed in this competitive democracy and pushed a referendum to repeal this law, and the referendum gave us the opposite result. Many times the left is criticized for depositing so much expectations on competitive democracy. Sometimes we hear this is a minimalist vision of democracy. However, the paradox is that the discourse of formal democracy and its concern to guarantee rights and this allowed political practices that were more democratic within the left, a left which recognizes and envisions other inequalities such as gender inequality. What are our future challenges? Well, this, in my research, I conclude that is to strengthen the link between the human rights traditional agenda and the new agenda. Our conceptual challenge is to include as part of human rights and understand human rights as many more things besides what the state defines, and strengthen the links between the party left and the social left, because the rights agenda is not complete. You need to include many more things because there are many rights that we need to have, and that this link will be very essential for this. So thank you very much. That's all.
Now we have time for questions and observations. So please.
Pardon, Michael. Gracias.
Thank you very much, Michael. I was listening to you and I kept reading again all the work that I mentioned at the beginning of this meeting. If it's okay with you, I'd like to mention some of the different countries that are here with us today in this part of Latin America and the Caribbean. For instance, we have the permanent representative of Nicaragua, Maria Luisa Lubiales de Chamorro. We have the DPR from Brazil, Guillermo Patriota. We have our colleague DPR from Chile, Honduras. So if you don't mind, I would really like to mention that this hasn't just happened because we are convened here to listen openly and keep our ears open, but we are here because we wanted to be here. We wanted to do this. I'd like ambassadors to, who have come here today by choice, if you'd like to make some comments now and maybe some ask some questions if you want to. Thank you. Microphone, please. First of all, I'd like to thank my friend Marita and the entire team of the Mission of Argentina for having invited us to this incredible and transparent and enriching debate. My first impression is that I would love to have them, all three of us, of you, during the debates in our different commissions, because of your honesty and transparency, really. There would be a better world if people like you were here with us all the time. We would really be able to reach that world that we believe possible. In Central America, specifically, I'd like to talk about, well, It's a very difficult situation. Central America has become, unfortunately, the pathway for organized crime, the organized crimes corridor in our small countries in Central America. And in terms of international drug trafficking, we're not producers nor consumers, but we are the greatest victims. Our situation is really very specific in Nicaragua. Citizen safety is very, very high, and safety is very high. Part of our democratic process has been to have institutions of the such as the army and the police, which were born of the people. These are democratic institutions. Our police has been catalogued as one of the most proactive police forces and the best police forces in the region. This is because of the democratic processes and of participative democracy. I'd like to share an experience from our national police. The command is not in the cities. They go to the inside of the country, and we have exchanges with people. So 153 municipalities of the country are part of these exchanges, so they can see the problem from the root, all the way from the bottom up. Specifically, I'd like to share a case with you. Our head of police, the commissioner, Amilda Ranera, she's visited these people, and somebody from the town said, "Miss Commissioner, we're discussing the war against drug trafficking here. However, your police boss is part of it. It's part of this whole wheels of drug trafficking." So we're trying to build a participative democracy here with a lot of difficulty because our people basically sets the agenda. The agenda comes from the bottom up. We have a number of challenges and difficulties still. And Central America itself is trying to help itself. Countries are trying to fight against this scourge, one of the main threats to democracy in Central America, the scourge of organized crime and drug trafficking, of trafficking of people, human trafficking. We just opened a training center in Nicaragua to train police forces from all of Central America. So we're trying to build this as best as we can. And as Professor Cohen was saying, our own democracy, because each of us has a different democracy. We're trying to build our democracy with citizen participation, grassroots participations. We're trying to bring back the rights of people who had been denied the rights for so many years. You know, we had almost 60 years of dictatorship, and we had a ferocious war against this very small country, and all this has been quite, well, it's caused many, many years of backwardness, but our democracy moves forward along with our brothers and sisters from Central America. We are aware that separate from public safety, because in Nicaragua that is very good, but if we don't replicate that in the rest of Central America, then there will come a time in which all of Central America would experience the same situation. So we are trying to build a region that is full of peace and safety, security. Thank you.
Embajador de Brazil?
The ambassador from Brazil. Thank you so much. I'm going to speak Portuñol. I would also like to thank Ambassador Percival from Argentina, as well as our team, for having organized this important event. I think we need to have these kind of events more often so that we can bring some air into the UN. This is quite necessary. We need younger people, not just younger, but more politicized, people who better reflect today's vision that brings us closer to national realities, you know, because, you know, diplomats, we just were here. It's important to have dialogue. As we were saying this morning during breakfast with the UNDP and Ms. Jessica Fayeta, the new person head of the region of Latin America and the Caribbean, our region is quite unique because of the way in which we build our democracy, which is very different from other regions in the world, where our democracy building process is very difficult. We have a very bloody history of centuries of European colonization, which was anti-human. Many do not want to see this, do not want to acknowledge this, they don't want to face this. We talk about the terrors of the great wars, but we don't talk very much about the terrors of the colonial period, especially in our region, which did not have the necessary freedom at the political international order to express its social conscience, a conscience for equality, for Afro-descendants, indigenous people, who, against their will, were brought to our region. Also, the different migrants that throughout history contributed to the growth and development of our countries. I think we have a common history unique to Latin America. The way of building democracy is also very different from any other region. We did not only obtain it through war, but we went through very difficult processes of national building and transformation. I would basically like to say three things. The gains in the last 30 years were important, even though today we still have lots of challenges that come from centuries of social deficit, as it was very well put by Claxo's director. The matter of violence, it is barbaric. It's humiliating for me as the representative of the government of Brazil to listen to the reality that there are the murder rates are unacceptably high in my country. But there were some gains, and these are fragile. And I think the UN needs to support this. We cannot think that social inclusion policies work, and so everybody here support this. No, that's not true. It is criticized every day. People say this is not a very good macroeconomic policy. This doesn't make any sense in terms of management. It's not supported by the monetary fund. But there is no vision by the membership of the UN that this is really the path to follow. But we believe this is. We know that it works. We know we can get results. We need to consider politics as a tool of democratic representation. But there is not that many other choices. The tendency of the business community and the media is to treat policies of our countries as second-class policies, something minor which is not has no credibility. I don't think that helps us strengthen our countries and our representative processes. I think we need to respect politics as is and, of course, improve it. Public policies of inclusion must be an acceptable process to build well-being in developing countries, countries that have been colonies, and that is different from building well-being in developed countries in Europe, which took great steps forward after many years of a bloody war, using the resources of our countries, such as mining, gold and silver. Violence, I believe, is a problem because it is true we need to fight it, but it is also an instrument of conservatism because violence is extreme violence is used in our countries to disseminate the culture of fear fear and prejudice against social segments that are more poor, against blacks, against those who are indigenous, you know, with policies of quotas, that is being eroded by the culture of projecting, of showing daily violence by the media in our countries. You know, we always see news of violence. And nobody mentioned this here, but the role of the media and the concentration and control of the media in our countries, which are in the hands of very few families. Sometimes only one family controls everything that's in the media. And the most read medias in our countries, in many countries even, at some point. Nobody mentions this. Nobody thinks it's necessary to have competition, market competition, so that we would have different actors. No, media doesn't need competitions. If you have one media controlled by some people outside, that's okay too. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ambassador Honduras, Mary Flores, Ambassador Flores.
Thank you very much. Por favor, que apriete el micrófono, si no, la interpretación no se puede hacer.
No. We can't hear from the booth. We can't hear.
Thank you very much to Claxon, to New School for their presentations. I'm delighted to listen to the vision of our youth, young researchers. I would like to share with you some of our opinions. Of course, that the most important legacy of the last century, it's the end of despotism and dictatorship and the rebirth of our human rights respected. We in our continent made great progress because we embrace democracy. The challenge of this century is what should we do to consolidate what of our achievement? How to consolidate the democratic processes? How to print more maturity on our institutions? How to respond urgently to outstanding issues so as not to fall into despair? How to eradicate poverty and give our populations more freedom? We are not small communities helping one another and sharing everything. No, coexistence has become colder, more remote. We have become a community in the global world. The transformation of the world, thanks to communication, shows us a new reality vis-a-vis the relationship of peoples in the world, and knowledge as well. There are no limits of limitation of knowledge. In seconds, we can obtain information concerning what's going on the other side of the planet. There are no prisoner countries where if we have communication, our governments are totally exposed. Nothing can be hidden. Everything is known. And the people's demand to be heard. How do these incipient democracies provide solutions to existing challenges? And how do we deal with the burden of old social problems? How do we find the means so as not to be left behind? How does democracy respond to the needs of many who live in poverty, who live, who suffer violence, who suffer inequality. How do we make them believe in the possibility of the future? How does democracy explain these inequalities? How do we explain the breach and the gap between those who have it all and those who have nothing? How do we make democracy work with so many needs, with so many outstanding issues? We need to go beyond political parties and elections. We need to practice democracy. Every day we need an exchange of power. We need to inspire collective trust through the solution of so many problems, promising that problems will be solved and delivering. The answer to the impossibility to deal with all of our problems is not an alternative. We need to work collectively because we're stronger that way. Latin America as one should exchange, should add up, should share, with no one left behind, with no marginalization, but with integration, with participatory, total integration. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Ambassador Galvez from Chile.
Bueno, muchas gracias, Marita. Yo quiero decir que ella la escucha.
Thank you so much. I'd like to say that we always listen to you at the Security Council, and you always speak outside the box in a different manner. And I think you've organized this very different seminar. I've been in many, many seminars. I've lived here for 5 years, and this is the first time I see this. And I'm also thankful to the New School, and an institution I very much admire, and I know many of their professors. Two things. Latin America certainly is a country at peace. There are no wars in every state, but it is still a region that is violent. As Guillermo said, we have these paradoxes. We've overcome old problems, but we've discovered new problems. This region somehow makes progress, not just in terms of leaving behind extreme poverty, because we still have a lot of that, but we have discovered inequalities and perhaps marginalization, to make it a bigger debate. Marginalization, as I see it from Chile, were those were of the sectors such as women and indigenous people. Sometimes this is a social matter and not just young people, which is what we've seen most in Santiago's streets, asking for different kinds of democracy, I don't know, but asking for a different way of expressing what society expects from the institutionality called the state. So the relationship between the state, society, and the market is what we're rethinking today, perhaps, and reevaluating. Chile, if you think about in terms of consultation and new majorities, we also alternated governments in between, and so this could speak of a democracy which is being built. But when we see what happens on the street, we see this isn't really quite so. We have, and I'm not sure I should say this, but the problem is that from the outside, we look great. We're used as the model of the best, and we know it's not so much so. And that the truth is that people are generous enough to try and find positive examples. But that is the truth when I see negotiations here. I have the feeling that things have happened moderately and that there's been some prudence in the changes. But it is, in fact, this prudence that the young people today see as fear, not to move forward and go towards to the end. once you move from a dictatorship or the military regime that were authoritarians. We're great at euphemisms in Chile, but what really happened is we had a brutal military regime and we moved on to democracy. We've had presidents who have done very good things, in my opinion. Some are very professorial, like a Chilean style, and now we have a female president that is closer to people. Oh. But nevertheless, this is a problem of variety. We look at Argentina very often because this is our big neighbor to our side. We look at Brazil and we know the processes are not the same. They're similar but not the same. We don't have identical problems, but there are similarities. Of course, there may be some things I'm sure that we haven't lived and experienced as hardly as our neighbors, but there are other things that we've experienced in a more terrible way. For instance, the disappeared. I know this also happened in Uruguay and Argentina, but probably in our country it was much bigger. So to conclude, because what's important is to listen to the young people here and not to for them to listen to the diplomats, but this idea of new rights, I believe, is excellent. This is a reality. Young people in politics is, in Chile, for example, something extremely important. I think you help us think. If we think about relationships between states of globalization, it's one thing, but you bring us again back to reality, the daily reality, the reality. As I was talking about, we don't talk about interstate conflicts. The Security Council always talks about most of the problems are civil wars, not interstate wars, which are, of course, always a possibility, and I know they're terrible, but our reality is new within the states and among states. So I'd like to thank Argentina and Marita Mateo for being here, for inviting us here, and I think I feel very proud also because there is a Chilean among you as a presenter and a researcher. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Councillor from Uruguay.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you so much, Dr. Cohen. First of all, I'd like to thank you for this invitation and convening us here today. I'd like to thank the Argentine Mission and this mission from Sweden. I'd like to thank the New School, Claxo, and especially the Observatory on Latin America. And I'd like to thank the students from this scholarship program, especially the three people who presented. And also take this opportunity to make some comments, because Ana Laura is part of this group of presenters. She's from my country, and she had some very interesting presentation focused on the internal aspects and on the process, not just of she didn't only mention important things such as the progress we've made in the laws, but also she mentioned how we got to this, especially the emphasis as of 2005 in human rights in my country. It's interesting because it helps us understand some of the aspects of our foreign policy. Of course, what happens inside, well, I mean, our foreign policy does relate to our domestic policy, the progress we've made within the laws, the open invitation, the transparency of all procedures as of 2005. So there is a number of things. I'm not going to list them all. And we also we were also part of the Council on Human Rights. We participated actively in the United Nations with matters of human rights. When we talk about democracy, we remember democracy and human rights in Uruguay, which are things that are completely intertwined. I grew up until I was 11 with a dictatorship, and although I was very young, I do remember some things from that time. So I must also mention what other colleagues have said, how important the region is, how the region is working in order to strengthen democracy throughout the different mechanisms of political coordination and systems of integrations that have included democratic clauses and have helped, and this also helps us strengthen democracy in the continent. But there's still some challenges. And as some of the presenters said, and my colleague said, there's still things in terms of social justice in my country, in the region. Well, my country has made a lot of progress in this aspect. I know we still have a lot to do. Foreign policy, Uruguay's foreign policy, has included this as priorities. For instance, the eradication of extreme poverty, education, health, food security, the importance of economic rights, cultural and social rights, which are a very important focus for the government in my country. To conclude, this has been also because of civil society's participation and academics in terms of thinking and bringing us the experiences that they have in the field in these matters. These contributions, such as what we've just heard, is to us something extremely important. So thank you very much, Argentina, for having invited us, and thank you. Thank you. Very well, thank you very much.
To speak or comment, please. Could you identify yourself?
Muchas gracias. En primer lugar, quisiera
Thank you very much. And first, I'd like to extend the apologies of the ambassador of Costa Rica, Mr. Olivares, because he had to leave. He had another commitment, but he asked me to express our thanks for this activity. I'd like to thank the ambassador of Argentina, who's always organizing important events for the region. I'd like to thank you for your continuous leadership. Also, we need to celebrate 30 years of democracy in Latin America. In some countries, we did not have to go through a period of denial of human rights. For example, Costa Rica had the good fortune of receiving with open arms people who came exiled from Central America and other countries from South America who have made important contributions, and many have become part of politics in my country. The contribution by these citizens of Latin America has been very important to us, and it helps us grow as a society. Democracy for Costa Rica is part of our DNA for many years now. Our stability allowed us to develop quite strong institutions, and we have mechanisms that have helped us face the political and social challenges. And there are many that we face. Democracy is about a process of constant process. We first need to see what our weaknesses are little by little, and through revisiting of the democracy structures that have been given us important spaces in the last few years, political parties were able to put an end to bipartisanship that we experienced for a long time in my country. All these things have allowed us to identify some of the challenges that we're still facing. Public safety is a big challenge for the region. For the last few years, we've made some changes which allowed us to decrease the crime rate by 3 points. We're the first country in Latin America that was able to do this. So I just wanted to mention that the possibility of having different models for democracy in the region has shown that that's the best way to continue developing in peace. And I think we need to feel proud of that. Latin America has different degrees of peace in different countries.
Thank you very much. Are there other queries or questions? Please. Could you identify yourself, please?
Muchísimas gracias.
Well, thank you very much, and good afternoon. My name is Julio Molinero. I'm from the Permanent Mission of Bolivia. And I bring you special greetings from the Ambassador Sacha Lorenti to you, Ms. Ambassador, but because he is presiding the G77, he was not able to be here, but he is a faithful advocate for democracy in all its aspects. So greetings, Ms. Ambassador. I'd also like to congratulate the panelists who have shown us different things that sometimes we know, but over time we may forget all these details. So it's always a good idea to bring them up. Bolivia, for example, as many of you know, or maybe some of you have just learned, democracy for the last 3 years has been essential. In fact, democracy has been strengthened, has been growing, and has allowed us to identify the participation of new actors in democracy. This allowed us to strengthen our democracy, civil society, indigenous people, and other actors have become part of this. Before, they were part of society, but they didn't play a direct role in the strengthening of democracy. Today, Bolivia promotes engagement in the process of change, which allowed society and indigenous people to support and guard democracy and participate. People who had no voice are now participating. In the last few years, even though we had all these new positive actors, we've seen other very negative actors. Every country has this. And I'm talking about, for example, organized crime, trafficking, human trafficking, narco traffic, which are things that in many countries may weaken democracy because of the international nature of these crimes. And whether you are consumer, producers, or transit countries, the process of democracy is affected by this, I would say. We need to remember that Latin America has been a blessed region with democracy in the last few years, and it allowed us to come here and discuss it and celebrate 30 years of democracy. So let's go forward. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. I'm Fernanda Milicanza. I'm from Argentina, from the mission. And if I could, I'd like to ask a question and make a comment. democracy as an institution and democracy as a content are extremely important for our countries as countries, and democracy as institutions and as content are also personal to an individual and a citizen. I've noticed people's different experiences. I liked all the different presentations, but I'd like to tell you about an experience that relates to my question. I began studying law under democracy, and when I first started studying, I noticed that there was a generational difference in the perception of human rights and democracy. To study human rights for me was just data. It was perfectly natural. But for attorneys that were older than me, we're talking about these kids from the Alfonsine plans who are studying human rights. So there was a generational gap between lawyers. There was a difference in the concept of what was a right and what was its relationship to democracy and human rights. So it's obvious that there are some subtleties in the political left and the social left claim with the students and the government, which sometimes is perhaps a little more stiff. So I think everyone, regardless of where we're from, have in common the fact that democracy and its content, not just institutions, need to be everybody's goal. Of the left, of the right, of the whites, of indigenous people, Afro-Americans, children. So back to my experience in studying law, I wanted to ask, have you thought about the role of education in strengthening and consolidating common conceptions of what the goals are for democracy and human rights? Thank you.
Alguien quiere contestar?
Anybody wants to answer that? I can't answer you. Your last question, because I don't study that specifically, but I can say something about what you said at first. The first thing you said, and in terms of Uruguay, which is what I studied and what I can have an opinion about, clearly there is a gap. Undoubtedly, in democracy and human rights, there is clearly a generation that was socialized in the struggle for human rights and fought to bring down the dictatorship. And, of course, there is a generational gap. But according to my research, after this gap, generational gap, the left in Uruguay had a lot of differences that were created during the 80s. And it had something to do with the strength of the party left in Uruguay. So the differences within the left made it so that people didn't work the same way and militate for human rights in the same manner. So this had an effect many years later when the left took the government. It was very difficult for it to share their cause within itself and with society. I don't really have any statistics on it to verify this, but in Argentina, you ask anyone on the street, I think this will happen, anything about human rights, because I go to Argentina very often, and I used to go every week for 3 years. I used to talk to the regular citizen. If you ask them about human rights, anybody would say, yeah, that's extremely important. But in Uruguay, the answer is yes, maybe. Oh, yeah, right, important. But there is a huge difference. So it's essential to have generations, but there are other differences than in the case of Uruguay, I think, affected the agenda later on.
Yo tampoco me he dedicado.
I haven't discussed and researched human rights in the curricula, it would be interesting to know how it has progressed. Nonetheless, I believe it is important to mention that, as you said, the notion of human rights should be internalized in all stakeholders, not only the leftists. Now that we celebrate the 40 years of the coup in Chile, it was very interesting to see the process within the left, the leftist movement. There was a conflict within this group because a very important part of the conservative party in Chile, and of course there was a generational cleavage, there's no doubt about that. The conservative sector of the conservative party was very critical to the coup, and President Piñera did the same. This actually, the debate stemmed from President Piñera's comments. I think it was a turning point regarding human rights agenda in Chile. As an anecdote, I can tell you that from the year 2000 until now, there were a series of things. For example, the scandal of the Pinochet wealth, which delegitimized them even more, maybe more than the violations of human rights. I remember to be shocked by the social acceptance of the coup and of Pinochet. And we see that less and less. It is now common ground to all of us that dictatorship was not good. And unfortunately, I cannot tell you anything about the human rights in the curricula at universities. I think it would be very interesting to listen to your to our colleagues who have precise answers to your questions. It's a pity we have time limits. There will be an answer, I'm sure of that. But in a brief comment, I would like to talk about the vacuum, the institutional vacuum, the participation of different social classes at an institutional level. And when the situation is not that, there is distrust, mistrust in democracy. There are so many counterpowers to civil society, and they dispute the spaces there where institutions are not playing their role. So it is of paramount importance for the state to be present. For example, we see that in Costa Rica, where the private forces of security play the role that the police should play. And this happens in Guatemala as well. The traditional tasks of institutions, which should guarantee minimal services, are of paramount importance for democracy and for the trust of society in democracy. Because if we, for example, privatize security, we find employment for citizens, we should ask ourselves, how these activities is dynamized? How do we find so many weapons in private hands? We need to fight this fear so present in our societies. We need to fight the concentration of the media such as the case of Mexico, we need to see that the government is present in institutions, but also it should be also present in the media. We need to strengthen the idea that social and institutional integration is one of the positive steps forward during these past 30 years. I think that we need to highlight the importance of social response to dominating movements or monopolies. We can think of another way. We can think of another way of monopolizing power, not only in a few hands. And in that sense, I would like to say that if we debate democracy in a context of mistrust, of frustration, of lack of expectations, we're not going far away. I believe that the two poles should be represented, the frustration and the challenges maybe, but also the expectations and the hopes. I appreciate all of your comments and questions.
Sí, también en nombre de Claxo agradecer la presencia de...
I'd like to thank all ambassadors and representatives of Latin American countries that are here today. And I'd like to thank the representatives from Europe and those who intervene. But after what Fernando said in terms of education and human rights, I think that it brings something essential to this debate that we need to discuss so much more in the next few years of democracy, in the processes of transition, especially countries that came from dictatorships, military dictatorships, which began processes of democratic institutions. And even in Costa Rica that did not experience this, 30 years ago, the discussion of what education was for was directly linked to the fact that education was needed to consolidate and strengthen democracy and strengthen a culture of peace and human rights. But in the last 30 years of democracy, where our democracy strengthened and the culture of peace made some progress, rather than attribute this to the education, we attribute this as a spontaneous means or to the media that is not always part of that. So we are very separated from this political dimension of education to call it something just business or productive. Education is good to train workers, and education is only good if it produces benefits and in the spirit of earnings and money. I think Fernando said this. I'm translating this to affirmations that we need to reconsider today, as Ana Sofia was saying. We need to rethink the new agenda for democracy and human rights. Education must play an essential role. And as Latin Americans, I think we need to see that our education systems may not be the best in the world, although they have played an essential role in the last 30 years, which is that they reevaluated its function and radicalized and make it improve, because we've been suffering a lot of pressure. Uruguay has one of the most democratic education systems in the world. It does very well in PISA, not so well, but the PISA test doesn't measure the degree of equality. And in Latin America, the equality measure is not something unimportant. Brazil has included more than 1.5 million young Afro-descendants in the first generation of students, which is an essential advance for Brazil and opens the door to other possibilities for poor young people in Brazil to know they may have the right to come into university. And that's important. 1.5 million is not a lot, but it's the opening. In Argentina, in the middle of the 20th century, this allowed Argentina to change its education system to a public system with opportunities, and the dictatorship pulled that apart. But at least there was the possibility in Uruguay, Argentina, and Chile, Costa Rica, that but being educated is not a privilege. And in Brazil, this was something recent. So this progress, this international view of education, which criminalizes public systems of education and seems not to take anything good from what's happening with our education systems, should really be looked at from Latin America's view to take back that political role and not a partisan role in terms of the future of democracy.
No quiero dejar de.
I would not like to end without highlighting the presence of Ms. Rosenthal, the representative of Guatemala, and she was for a reference for my generation. My generation that is not dyed in one color. We debated ideological and ethical projects, and we still do, at a national, at a regional, at a world level. Mr. Gert, we read him when we were victims of the terrorism of state. We read him as an economist for social justice, and he greatly contributed as an ECLAC director to think of economics redistributing wealth. I had the joy of sharing a year of the Security Council with him. So I wanted to highlight his presence here. Pablo, thank you so much for your comments. And thank you all, friends. Everyone mentioned that this is not very frequent, that we should organize these events more frequently because they're very beneficial to our debate. Please bear in mind the importance of the political dimension of the decision we took. It was not that easy. At the time, the Berlin Wall still existed. It was not easy. The United Nations is a space where sudden dynamics are present. We see violence, we see regression, and we see repression of rights as a right. The fact that we are here reflecting upon these rights is important. Your research, your papers that I read very thoroughly are very interesting, and they are very diverse as well. I would really like to discuss with you certain points. Uruguay coordinated the Conference for Population and Development in Cairo, and we spent 2 nights without sleep, because we wanted to make our principles be respected. Uruguay had to negotiate, and we were behind your way. We were in a fight with we activists for human rights were fighting against activists for the violation of human rights. It is not that evident. It is not that easy, let me tell you. Sexual and reproductive health and the rights linked to this are of paramount importance. We are going to lead a debate on this, and we hope to have Pablo as one of our team. We're debating the sustainable development goals nowadays, and we see people questioning whether education should be a right or not. And the growth models, as Guillaume Patriota was saying, when we get far away from the orthodoxy that still exists, we are questioned. Even here, we are populist. Even here at the United Nations, we are not invited to events. Here, the palace of multilateralism, the palace of the celebration of differences. But there are so many cleavages. There are differences greater than others. And we have to bear that in mind. I appreciate your comments and your presentations very deeply. When the trials began against the terrorism of state in Argentina, recognizing that in 1983 the trials began, the lines of shame, and then we saw this loss of shame, the change in policies. Our struggle was more fierce than ever. We didn't want the privatization of education. We did not want exclusion in education. We did not want that education belongs to a few. We wanted to avoid the poor boys from shanty towns to sell drugs because it was the only way out he could find. We want for this world to be over, to be in the past. Ideologies are not over. Latin America and the Caribbean are still debating. Not all governments have the same vision or perspective. Is this a bad thing? Not at all. It's a great thing. But we need to be capable of organizing resistance, resisting to those against those who do not believe in democracy, who do not believe in human rights. Sustainable development goals. We are discussing that nowadays. If Rajoli wrote that we could not give an opinion concerning human rights in the international arena, today it is the opposite situation. We still need to do a lot. We need you for that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marita. That's probably a good way to end this session with your inspiring comments and critical warnings to think about these things. I'd just like to add from the academic side, from the New School, downtown, just 20, 30 blocks away, there's another space. It's a university space, which in this city has always been open to critical debate. And as President Van Zandt said, to discussing with people who aren't always accepted and ideas which aren't always accepted. And so we're delighted to participate in this event and to welcome any and all of you at the New School for other events as we do things about Latin America. And we'd just like to thank CLACSO, our partners in this activity, and particularly thank the fellows and thank our presenters here. I think it's been a wonderful morning. So thank you very much.